This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We're going to be spending quite a lot of time over the next couple of weeks together. I might just mention at this stage, by the way, that the fourth lecture, which we had advertised for Wednesday night, the 8th of July, I think it was, will have to be changed to Tuesday night, the 7th of July. That's the last lecture. Instead of the Wednesday night, it'll have to be the Tuesday night. Sorry if there's some good TV programs on Tuesday night, but I tried to arrange with SABC TV to switch the English and Afrikaans as well, which they wouldn't do. And we're going to be discussing the most important and the most troubling relationship between human beings, not just in the modern world, but a relationship which has always existed and always will exist, hopefully, but a relationship which has become more troublesome in recent times. The divorce rate in Jewish circles in Johannesburg has soared over the last 5 years as compared to all previous similar periods. Statistics that I looked at from the year 1950, I think it was, taking 1950 to 55 as a 5 year period, the marriage divorce ratio stayed fairly static at about 14%, right up until 1975 virtually. From 75 to 80, it increased a little bit in the 70 to 75 period, and in the 75 to 80 period, it doubled. So we're looking at something which is becoming increasingly endemic. And I always say I'm not worried about the 1 in 3 that are getting divorced. Hopefully they've sorted out their problems and they've made the best of a bad job. I'm worried about the 2 in 3 that remain married. Because from what we see, those 2 in 3 who remain married are not necessarily happily married. And if 1 in 3 lands up in divorce, if 33% are landing up in divorce, of the other 66%, you're talking about quite a percentage that would like to get divorced but don't want to because of the children or because of social pressures or things aren't quite bad enough to warrant divorce. So you're talking about a tremendous percentage within that two-thirds that remains married, a tremendous percentage of people who are not happily married. And it's tragic that an institution as essential as marriage, as old as marriage, as desired as marriage, because everybody's still falling for it somehow, is not proving successful. Any other project that received this kind of rating success-wise would have been abandoned by mankind. And yet marriage is pursued, and we'll understand by the end of it why, and it's pursued with total lack of preparation, it's pursued with misguidance. And most important of all, you know, when you learn to swim, one of the important reasons for learning to swim is not just to enjoy yourself in the water, but to know what to do in an emergency. And couples are so ill-prepared to understand what to do when their marriage is in a state of emergency. How to get themselves out of a crisis. We just find that couples have no idea as to how to cope. Furthermore, one of the perhaps the most disturbing facts altogether about it is that this increase in divorce rate is primarily with people who've been recently married. We're looking at a tremendously high percentage of young divorces. And I made a point recently when I spoke on the subject of the fact that it's the youth of the 1960s, the teenagers of the 1960s who were busy teaching the world about love, you'll remember, and how to get on with one another, and how to stop fighting, and how to love one another, and how to have peace. peace for all mankind. They were the ones who were coming to break the gospel to the world that they'd never heard before, that one should love one another. And they're the people who are not able to handle love relationships in percentages just unbelievable compared to their parents and grandparents. I don't accept the view that the reason that divorce has increased so radically is because it's easier and more socially acceptable. I think that's got something to do with it, but only very little. Because again, what I'm talking about is not the divorce rate. Divorce I still consider to some degree a successful end to a marriage. It's an end to a marriage, but it's in a sense it's a successful end to a marriage. What I'm worried about is the marriages that persist with difficulty and that could be successful but just aren't successful because the couple don't know how to handle it. The most amazing thing about young people getting married today is exactly the same as it's been said about the average man is the man who believes he isn't. And the average young couple who get married are convinced that their marriage is going to be very different. It's not going to be the same as their parents, and it's not going to be the same as everybody else. It's going to be very unique and very special, very different. And the biggest tragedy about that average couple, because it's absolutely average and absolutely standard, the biggest tragedy is that they're right. Their marriage turns out to be nothing like their parents, and nothing like their grandparents, and nothing like anybody else's. Except not for the good, usually for the bad. The misery, the unhappiness, the bitterness, the lack of progress. And this is all new. It's all relatively new. Certainly in the Jewish world, it's relatively new. A successful marriage is not a marriage that doesn't land up in divorce. Just the same as a successful business is not a business that doesn't go bankrupt. Business that goes bankrupt was an unsuccessful business. A successful business is a business that makes a lot of money. And a successful marriage is a marriage that facilitates growth in each individual far beyond the growth that would have been possible had each individual remained on their own. And what we're finding more and more in Jewish and non-Jewish marriages, religious and non-religious marriages, that on the contrary is happening. That husband and wife are both stifling their growth through their marriage. They're both limiting their progress. They're both finding that they're able to express themselves and reach heights to a lesser degree than they could have if they were married, if they weren't married. And this is terribly troubling. Now, Western norms have taught us already, or we have seen already, that our normal Western norms are inadequate for coping with marriage. Marriage is not modern, and people are not modern. Marriage is 5,000 years old, a little more than that, and people are just as old, and they've been marrying each other since the beginning, and we're not going to learn anything in modern terminology or in modern philosophy, contemporary thinking, that is going to throw any more light on marriage than if we in fact examine what they knew about marriage thousands of years ago, or hundreds of years ago, or even tens of years ago. We've decreased our sensitivity to marital problems. We've decreased our understanding of marital problems. Marriage failure is more today than it used to be. And so for once we've got to look at this not from a technological viewpoint, not to try and find the most up-to-date and modern views, but rather to go back a little bit and find out what is essential about a marriage, what is basic about a marriage, and how can one be sure that we're able to live a marriage in the style that they used to. Lifestyles change a little bit, professions change, attitudes change. All that has to be catered for and all that can be catered for. But the basic marital relationship, a man relating to a woman in marriage, that relationship is old. And we're going to find our understanding to it then, not now. And so the concepts that I'm going to give you over the next couple of weeks are going to be very often different to what you're used to hearing, and I hope that that's why you've come here. What one's used to hearing is not working. The normal techniques and talk and philosophies just aren't working. And I'm going to give you an approach to marriage which is old, which is very old. An approach which in some ways will sound very contemporary and in some ways will sound very old-fashioned. And I ask that you don't listen to it from the angle of whether or not you agree with what I'm saying. Because I don't plan to tell you the kind of things you agree with. I plan to tell you the kind of things you don't agree with. I plan to stimulate your thinking in a way that hopefully will lead you ultimately to accept and understand what it is that we're talking about. But I do ask of you that you put your full attention to understanding what I'm saying. Don't worry whether you agree or not. It's one of the problems of modern audiences. They listen to whether they agree or not. If they agree, they listen further. If they don't agree, they turn off. And that's a very stifling attitude to education altogether, because you don't have to hear what you agree with. What you agree with, you know already. What one has to study and learn are viewpoints with which one does not agree. One has to learn to understand viewpoints with which you don't agree. Having understood those viewpoints, you're entitled to disagree with them. But please don't disagree with them before you've understood it. That's all. And feel free, after each lecture, to raise whatever questions you wish. Our conception of marriage is going to be idealistic only in as much, and here we make our first departure from the normal way of looking at it. Our conception is going to be idealistic only in as much as it's going to be aimed towards ideals. But it's not going to be based on ideals. A marriage that is based on ideals is just not based on reality. We're going to base our understanding on the reality of what a man is and what a woman is. What a man is essentially and what a woman is essentially. And what a union between a man and a woman is. And what problems must be expected in such a union. That's what we're going to really base it on. We'll aim towards ideals. But one of the biggest problems in a marriage is that it starts off basing itself on ideals. You can't base anything on an ideal. You've got to base it on fact. You've got to base it on reality. And we're going to have to see that human happiness is achieved primarily through understanding reality and working from there, not working from the ideals. Understand who you are. When you know who you know your limitations and your abilities. You know your strengths and your weaknesses. Then you can start finding happiness within you. But if you don't understand that, and if you're constantly going to be looking towards ideals without being prepared to pay sufficient attention to the facts and to the limitations of reality, you're never ever going to find happiness, and certainly not in marriage. So that's where we're going to have to start. Falling in love, by the way, just before we start, is something which doesn't happen, believe it or not. Because you'll see by the time we're finished that what love requires is something so much deeper than can possibly be achieved through falling in love. Falling in love is instant. And it's like a connoisseur of coffee telling you what he thinks about instant coffee, or a connoisseur of anything good telling you what he thinks about instant results. There's nothing of value, there's nothing spiritual and nothing qualitative which can possibly be achieved instantly. If you've achieved it instantly, you know it's not the real thing. When a man and a woman fall in love, they can know for sure that they don't love one another. They may come to love one another, maybe. But whether a couple comes to love one another or not has nothing to do with whether they were once in love or not. Because these 1 in 3 that we're talking about, and the other 50% or whatever it is that are unhappily married, they were all in love one day. They all started off that way, particularly the young ones. Falling in love is quite a modern phenomenon. Our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents didn't fall in love that easily as we do. And yet they stayed married longer and more happily than we do. So falling in love has nothing to do with love. Love is something spiritual. Love is something qualitative. It's something human and it's something emotional. And instant emotions are shallow, and instant love is shallow. We're going to talk about how one cultivates the real love. How one cultivates the true feeling that there has to be between a husband and a wife in order for that to last, in order for that to exist. Now the dividing line between tonight's talk and next week's talk is very arbitrary. And both talks together really form a circle, and I could start anywhere, and I've just got to get back to where I started. There isn't really a beginning to it. I'm going to try as far as possible to structure it with first principles first, but really you'll have to regard tonight's and next week's as one talk. And by the time we finish it, there might be quite a lot unclear tonight, which will only be clarified next week. And there might be quite a lot unconcluded tonight. So you must forgive me on that, but there's no way that I can finish the whole of the first section in one evening. The last time I did a course like this, we took nine lectures over it. We did it fortnightly, and we took nine evenings. I'm trying to condense it all into four. I hope I'll be successful. That's the reason that I have requested that you come to everything. Because in these areas, if you don't know, you don't know. Ignorance is bliss. But to know half the story is terribly dangerous. For a couple to be present when I talk about the husband's obligations and not to be here when I talk about the wife's obligations can literally lead to divorce. And if a couple is here when I talk about the wife's obligations and not about the husband's obligations, it will lead to divorce. And since the purpose of these talks are to lead to happier marriage, it's essential that you come to the whole lot. Particularly, I didn't want people coming to future talks who hadn't been at the first one or the second one, where the basic principles are going to be laid down, which we're going to come back to and talk about as we go through the series. But likewise, I would like you to make every effort that you possibly can. Those of you who are already here, if you don't want to stay, the time to go out is now. If you decide to stay on, please try and just commit the next four Wednesday nights, because I would hate you to have an imbalanced idea. I have said that where one party of the couple can't come, it's alright. It's not alright, but it's acceptable. Because hopefully that party will convey what was said. But that's your own risk. Don't send your wives here when I'm talking about the husband's obligations. Or also the other way around. Don't send your wives here when I'm talking about the wife's obligations. So please try and make the whole lot. Still by way of introduction, but this is the first thing we have to do, is dispel the, I won't say it's a myth, because I don't think anybody really believes it. Dispel the misconception, dispel the idea which has been tried to be spread over the last 20 years, that men and women are equal, and that men and women are the same, and that women have the same rights as men, and men have the same rights as women. They don't. Men and women are not equal, and men and women are not the same. Men and women are very different, and if my wife wasn't very different to me, there would be something wrong with me if I married her, and likewise with every one of you. It's because of that difference that we get married, and the pressures to which we're subjected, you don't even know what pressures it is, but we're constantly being subjected. Through the television, through the newspapers, through books that are being written, presenting marriage, not only marriage, just presenting man-woman relationships on some kind of an equal basis. That isn't so. Doesn't mean that men are more equal than women or that women are more equal than men. It just means they're completely different. It's like talking about the weather in South Africa is exactly equal to the height of Everest. You just can't compare them. There's no way you can talk about equality or the sameness or equal rights or anything like that when you're talking about a man and a woman. We have to view, for the purposes of these discussions, in order to understand the functioning of a marriage, we have to view man and woman almost as members of different races. Just completely different things. And it's like talking about a polar bear is equal to a monkey. They're just completely different. They just work in different ways. Likewise, a man and a woman are totally different. We'll come to understand their similarities later. Their superficial similarities everybody knows about. But before we can talk about the coming together of two parties, it's necessary to know in what way they're different. and to be able to respect those differences and understand those differences and function in accordance with those differences. Because if we don't, we're going to be constantly out of phase. In any relationship between two people or between a man and an object, in any relationship at any given moment, you will find that the two parties to the relationship are not equal. At any given moment, somebody is leading the relationship and somebody is being led by the relationship. It's very, very seldom, if ever, the two people are interrelating on an absolutely equal basis. Somebody is manipulating, somebody is being manipulated. He might choose to be manipulated. It's not as if he's being manipulated involuntarily necessary. He might be willing to put himself under the influence of the manipulator. A patient who goes to a doctor, a student who goes to a lecturer, is putting himself in the hands of the other, who is going to be, so to say, manipulating the relationship for that period of time. And so it is with two friends, or the parent and a child, at any given moment. It's terribly important to appreciate this and understand this. At any given moment, somebody is controlling the relationship. Somebody is directing the relationship. You know very well what happens when nobody's directing the relationship. You sit there and you discuss how the children find things, and the weather also good, and what did you do in your holidays? We went to Muesenberg. That's the kind of discussion that you have if nobody's in control. But where somebody is in control, the relationship can be a dynamic one, but somebody has to be in control of the relationship. That's not only between man and man, that's even between man and object. We're going to discuss this over and over in all its different facets as we go through the discussion, because this is one of the very basic principles on which all relationships, particularly a marriage relationship, is based. But just to give you an example, a human being has to be in control of the relationship between himself and his things. He must know how to switch off a television set the same way as he knows how to switch on a television set. A man who doesn't know how to switch off a television set until their national anthem comes on and they show that final, you're back to the test thing, that's when they turn the television off, and until that's there they can't turn it off. Such a man is being controlled by his television. There the subject-object relationship is reversed, the human being becomes the object and the television becomes the subject. One uses a watch to tell the time, and one wears the watch when it suits one to wear the watch, and one puts it down when one wants to put it down, and one uses it to tell the time. But I've seen people who buy watches that are made from all sorts of precious and lovely things and aren't worth anything the amount they pay for them. And they don't own and master the watch. The watch owns and masters them. They only can wear it on special occasions, and it's locked up in the safe, and they lie in bed worrying about it, and they have sleepless nights about it. They are totally under the influence and in the control of their little watch. And so one has to find, even in one's material relationships, one has to exercise care to make sure that at all times you are in control of your relationship with your physical things. When we come to discussing parents and children, there it really goes chaotic to see the number of parents who are totally under the control of their children, but absolutely, and are terrified of their children, and whose children have them around their little fingers. When one realizes the number of parents that are in that position, apart from feeling desperately sorry for them and for their children too, one realizes the inadequacy of people in terms of their preparedness to cope with parenthood as well as with marriage. The man and the woman. The most primitive difference between a man and a woman stems from their physiological makeup. God chose not to make us like earthworms. He made us different. Male and female are different. And if one analyzes philosophically what the difference is that man gives and the woman receives. That's the difference. And man is designed to give and the woman is designed to receive. That's the whole body structure, the whole physiology, the whole sexual relationship, which we'll come to in the fourth lecture, is built around that premise. Now that doesn't disturb equality. It doesn't mean that the one who receives is less equal or more equal than the one who gives, but it's different, completely different. And we see here an indication by the Creator of man, how he wants that relationship to function. And we're going to use this also right through. It's man giving to lady, man giving to woman. That doesn't mean there aren't times when the man takes from the woman. It doesn't mean that the woman is not able to give to the relationship. She's able to give in an enormous way. But we'll discuss all that. But on its basic level, man gives to woman. It applies in the sexual area. It applies in the material area. It is unnatural and abnormal for the woman to be the breadwinner. Doesn't mean that a woman shouldn't work, but it is abnormal for the woman to be the breadwinner. It doesn't mean that sometimes a couple have to do that. Sometimes it just that's how it is for various reasons, which again we might discuss in the future. But it's abnormal when that happens. And one of the very important things for happiness is to know when you're abnormal and to cater for your abnormality rather than to convince yourself that it's in fact normal. Sometimes one has to say, this is not normal, this is not the way it should be, but it's the way it has to be temporarily. Okay, then one knows where one stands. I listened to shock with a woman sociologist recently who claimed that children of single parent homes, that means where one parent is raising the child either because the couple are divorced or because one has died, feel that their rights are interfered with. Because when they study in that school and they have little books, picture books and textbooks, it always shows the family with two parents. And they only have one parent. That's discrimination against the child of the one parent family. That was the case she put. And there are moves overseas, she said, with pride, to correct this by ensuring that textbooks in the future will show only one parent with the child. So that a child from a one parent home shouldn't feel uncomfortable. And I got up at that symposium and I simply put the question whether we now have to draw children with hunchbacks in all our books so that children with hunchbacks shouldn't feel uncomfortable, and all the children should only have one leg so the children with one leg should also feel comfortable, and all the other abnormalities, our television program should show children stuttering so that a kid who stutters feels comfortable too and feels that he's normal. There's this absurd attempt to make abnormal people feel comfortable, to make criminals feel part of society, to make people who are sick feel that they're healthy. That's not the way to cure problems. The way to cure problems is to explain to a person that they have a problem, where the problem stems from. There's nothing to be ashamed about. The problem can be coped with, and to teach the person to cope with the problem. Likewise, it's important to know in the material area, if a woman is the breadwinner, that's abnormal, and it places a certain stress on the marriage. It might be necessary, but it's not the way a normal marriage should be run. Similarly, on an emotional level, it's the man who feeds emotion into the marriage, believe it or not the lady. It's the male who feeds the female with emotion and with spirituality. A home needs a certain spiritual input in order to function, and by spiritual I don't mean religious necessarily. I mean a system of values. And the man has to be the provider of that system of values. Doesn't mean that in many successful homes it's not the other way around. It is sometimes the other way around, but that's abnormal when it's the other way around. And abnormalities can survive. Doesn't mean because it's abnormal it will end in chaos or that it will end in tragedy. An abnormality can survive, but the couple must appreciate that it is in fact abnormal. We're going to expand on that a lot more next week when we discuss the roles of the husband and the wife, how they interrelate with one another, particularly bearing in mind these uniquenesses. As far as we're concerned tonight, what's important is to understand the consequent feeling of insecurity in a woman. Now, a man who feels emotionally insecure is a man with a problem. I know that sounds funny to you because in our modern day and age, all, just about, men in Western society feel insecure. And that's part of the problem we're going to have to confront. Because that's really where the marriage shakes. When the man feels insecure. And the man needs security from his wife. That's like needing money from your wife. The security comes from the husband. The husband, who is the giver, is able to feel more secure. Imagine for a moment, not that I'm making any kind of comparison at all, but I think you'll understand what I mean. Imagine the relationship of the giver of charity to the receiver of charity. The receiver of charity is constantly worried. Is the giver going to turn up? Is he going to have money to give me? Will he feel like giving it to me? Will he be in a generous mood when he meets me? He's constantly insecure and worried because his source of income is another man. Whereas the giver of charity doesn't have that feeling of insecurity. He's got the money. So it's a question of whether you'll find the poor man to give it to him or not. Whether you'll give him 10 cents or you'll give him 20 cents. That's all that he's worried about. But there's no feeling of insecurity on the part of a giver. A giver, being able to give, is the greatest feeling of security. Eric Fromm says that an expression of wealth is not how much you've got, but how much you spend. That having money doesn't mean you're wealthy. Because you're not potent with your money, you're not achieving anything with it. The measure of wealth, the measure of richness, is how much money you're able to spend. That's what really measures how wealthy you are. And the measure of security too is one of how much you're capable of giving. The more you can give, the more secure you feel. Now a woman, and I say again that a lot of this I'm afraid you're not going to understand and not going to agree with and not going to fully appreciate tonight. It's going to take next week and possibly the week after before it starts fitting into place really. But at this stage, try to understand just the facts with which we're dealing. The fact is that a woman is created in a way where she is receiver. And although she's created that way physiologically, we're going to show that that's meant to be expressed not only physiologically and sexually, but in every area of the relationship. She is basically fulfills her function by receiving and encouraging the male to give. We'll discuss how. But that's her basic function in the marital relationship. The parental relationship is totally different. But in the marital relationship, that's her function. Imagine then, accept that as an axiom for a moment. That a woman's function is to receive, and she receives from her husband. And her husband is the generator. He makes the money, and he makes the emotion, and he makes the spirituality, and he injects it into the household. Imagine her feeling of insecurity or worry about her husband's capacity to provide her needs. Because she needs him. A husband can generate his own income, and he can generate his own emotion, and he can generate his own spirituality, and he can generate a lot of things. Which a woman can't do within the marital framework. If she's married, a lot of that has to go through the husband. And if she fears that her husband is incapable or unwilling of giving her everything that she needs, she has a tremendous feeling of insecurity. When we come to discussing dating in a few moments, it plays a very important part there. Because there's basically a conflict of motivation in modern day Johannesburg or London or New York dating. It's one of the most dishonest relationships that exist. The boy-girl relationship before marriage. It's a relationship of cheating and misleading. Particularly in this area. The boy is out for fun. He wants a good time. He takes out girls long before he's thinking of marrying. He takes out girls that he has no intention whatever of marrying. And I assure you, I've done plenty of surveys on this, that there is hardly a woman, I'm talking about a decent woman, who goes out with a man without constantly thinking in her mind, could this possibly lead to marriage? Is this the kind of man I want to live with? She doesn't go on dates for fun. She sometimes goes on dates for social pressure because she's embarrassed in case the telephone rings on a Saturday night and she answers it. That's just not done in Johannesburg. She's supposed to be out. So sometimes that's the reason that she might accept to go on a date. But if it's a serious date on which she's going willfully, it's because she believes that there's a possible potential of marriage. And if she knew that there was no chance, she wouldn't go out with that particular guy. And she certainly wouldn't go to bed with him. Absolutely out. Every girl who goes to bed with a guy before she's married believes in the back of her mind, maybe this is how I'll catch him. Maybe this is what he wants. Maybe this is the way the relationship has to develop before it comes to marriage. But no decent girl, and I'm not talking about decent being a particularly pious girl. I'm just talking about the average normal girl that we all know. No decent ordinary girl would go to bed with a man before marriage if she thought it had no chance of leading to marriage. And he just wants an evening of fun, that's all. And that's supposed to be an honest relationship which is supposed to lead to a successful marriage. How anybody expects that, I don't know. But we'll discuss that still. All I wanted to show at this point is that the woman's need for security is what is paramount in her dating. She wants marriage. She doesn't want a boyfriend. She wants a home. She wants somebody who's going to care for her. She wants somebody who's going to love her. She wants somebody who's going to provide for her always. She wants somebody she can lean on in a crisis. That's what she wants. She doesn't want fun tonight. She's prepared to sacrifice the fun tonight to make sure that she gets the kind of husband that she wants, somebody that she can live with in the kind of way that we're discussing. And if that were denied her, if she knew from the outset that that is out, she wouldn't be out with him. The next important difference between man and woman is one which also stems from physiology. It stems from the female cycle, which is something which keeps a woman in very close touch with reality. A woman does not easily find herself becoming totally abstractly involved, losing all touch with reality. We're going to discuss this a great deal later on as well, but it comes very much as a shock to women when they find out that when their husbands are busy at work, or busy with a hobby, or busy with friends, they actually forget about their homes. And it's not a healthy situation if a husband can't do that. When he's busy at work, he's completely involved in another world, and his home really doesn't exist. When the phone rings and it's his wife on the phone to tell him that the lawnmower is broken, it's actually like waking up from a nightmare or from a dream. It's another world all of a sudden. Something at home again, and he suddenly remembers he's got a home too. But at the time that he's working, there's nothing in his mind. He's involved in a different world. Not only when he's working, but when he's sitting at home, tinkering around in his workshop or learning Gemara in his study or reading English literature, whatever it is that he likes to do, at that time, believe it or not, the home virtually doesn't exist. And he can click out of that and come back to home. A woman can't understand that, never mind do it. Because even when a woman reaches the top of her career, and she's a career woman and she's successful, she's never completely separate from her home and from her family. She's always worried about home, she's always thinking about home, she's always planning about home. She finds it a pleasant break going away from home, that's for sure. But she's never totally isolated from her home and from reality. A woman has her 2 feet on the ground. I must say, by the way, when I'm talking about man-woman, I'm talking about a theoretical situation of 100% man and 100% woman. Most of us are a bit of a mixture in between, which is also part of the problem. But this is how a man should be and how a woman should be. And most women are on this half of the concept of the man-woman relationship, and most men are on the other half, if not completely over to the extreme. So most women have their 2 feet on reality. In reality, they're connected with the world, they don't lose touch with the world, they're constantly brought back to reality, child-bearing, child-raising, domestic responsibilities, the whole lifestyle, and it's not just the lifestyle, again, it stems from the physiology, it's the way God chose to make her, keeps her in close contact at all times with the world around her. And that's why it's also so absurd, the experiments that they started doing in Scandinavia 15 years ago, and they gave up about 5 years ago, so now they're trying them in South Africa, having given up unsuccessfully in Scandinavia, they're giving it a go in South Africa. The ideas of trying to eliminate the differences between men and women by educating them in a particular way, and the view that a man is just as capable of staying at home, let the woman go out to work and let the man stay at home. It's just so contrary to the strengths and weaknesses of each. The man stays at home looking after the children. What does he do? The children run outside to play, and he picks up a book to read. And he doesn't even hear when the child falls down and cuts his throat, and he doesn't even hear if nothing happens. He's busy reading. And a woman can't understand that. But didn't you hear the child cry? Didn't you see? Weren't you watching? That's how it is. And the woman goes off to work, and she sits there worrying about her husband, whom she knows won't even hear if the baby cries. So what's the idea of sending the woman off to work and keeping the man looking after the children? It's just not how we function. A man can abstract himself. A man takes pleasure in abstract thinking, in thinking which has no practical relevance whatever. A man can sit and abstractly think about the most obtuse concepts and be enraptured by it. And a woman wants to know tachlis. So what? What is it all going to do? What's the practical relevance? She can't understand what he's going on about if it has no practical relevance. And that's why a woman doesn't need those mitzvahs in the Torah which are time-orientated. A man has to be brought into constant touch with the rhythm of reality. If he doesn't daven shachris in the morning and mincha in the afternoon and ma'ariv in the night time, he doesn't know whether it's day or night. He's completely distracted if he's really doing well at his work. He won't know what's going on. He has to break his work to daven mincha, and he has to stop what he's doing to daven ma'ariv. He has to do those mitzvahs which constantly bring him down to a rhythm of living, to a certain cycle of living. A woman has her own inborn cycles. She knows what time of the day it is, she knows what time of the week it is, and she knows what time of the month it is. She has her own calendar system and her own cycles, and she never has to worry about losing touch with reality. But that's a difference between man and woman which we have to understand and which we have to face. It expresses itself further in one other area, and that's the area of imagination. Believe it or not, a woman's imagination, again, I'm talking generally, and it is a generalization, obviously. A woman's imagination is not anywhere near as sophisticated as a man's imagination. That's contrary to what most people believe. By imagination, I mean the ability to conceive of something which has never been conceived before. And that requires sophisticated, abstract ability. One has to conceptualize something completely new. You can't start off from any given factors. You're jumping into the air. And to be able to abstract yourself from all relevant factors and from all given factors, and to be able to jump off into new areas and create something which has never been thought of before, that a man does better than a woman. And the way that I always illustrate that is by showing that even in those professions where women have always been predominant, cooking and baking and dressmaking and hairstyling and all this kind of thing, the new conceptions, the new designs, the new ideas are male-inspired, not female-inspired. A woman is capable of doing tremendous sophistication on an idea which has been invented. She can improve it, she can make it practical, she can redesign it, she can change it, she can give it color and she can give it life. But that initial conception of something which never existed before, that she can't do as well. And that too is very important. We're going to come to that now in the next section, which is the section of dating. Dating. It's important even for those of you who are married already to understand the principles of dating. Because you'll understand how fortunate you are, or how unfortunate you are, and what to do about it in a way which might throw a lot of light on your relationship. There are really only two ways of man meeting woman. Either by shadchan, believe it or not, even in the modern day, either by shadchan. Right. Shadchan, for those of you who are not familiar, is the marriage agent, the broker. Or by pure luck. Just happened to be. There's no other way. Either somebody introduced you, and we laugh at the old shadchan system, the old system of a marriage broker. But there's nothing to laugh about, because that's how most marriages even today are made. Oh, you're a nice young man, I must introduce you to so-and-so, I must give you so-and-so's number, a lovely girl, you should go out together. That's how it happens. And if you ask yourselves, you'll find that you're either... well, let's just try it. Who got married by shadchanis? And somebody who gave you a number to phone, somebody who was some kind of introduction. Is that all? The rest was just pure dumb luck, as Rabbi Bernard calls it. The other way is that you just happen to see the other party at some party, or standing at a bus stop or at work, and you happen to ask them out. A chance meeting, which it appears is the way most of you got married, those of you who are married, seems as if there were only three or four who had shadchanim. A chance meeting, put it this way, if I didn't believe in God, I would say it has no chance of working, whatever. And what chance is it? You happen to meet a girl and you like her. What do you like about her when you happen to meet her the first time? She looks good, she's dressed nicely, she's pretty, she's attractive, she's vivacious, oh, whatever it is, the most superficial things is all you can possibly notice. So you go out with her and you find, in fact, she is attractive and she is nice and she is vivacious, so you go out again and again and again, and you get involved and you still don't know the first thing about one another and you get married. Why should it work? It does happen to work because there's somebody guiding one. That's the only kind of explanation that one can possibly give For as I say, what Rabbi Bernard calls the pure dumb luck introductions. It happens to be that way. By far the most effective is correctly practiced shadchanis. A shadchan in the old days was a guy who knew both families well, and who knew both children well, and had known them since they'd grown up as kids, and knew their difficulties and their strong points. Kindle should meet Rifkele and they should go out maybe. Let them see. And even today, a personal introduction obviously has a lot of preference over just happening to meet. Be that as it may, since it appears that most people are meeting by pure dumb luck and not by shadchanis, the next important thing is to ensure that very early on in the relationship, and I'll explain soon why it must be very early on, the couple seeks some objective advice. Because having become attracted to each other initially, their ability at critical and brutally critical thinking becomes considerably impaired. If you walk past a shop window and there's something you really like, and you set your heart on it, and the shopkeeper tells you, yeah, but they're better ones, and you ask around and people tell you, no, but you can do better than that, and it's not worth the money that you'll spend on it, and if you're going to spend that amount of money, rather do this, or rather wait a few months, a new model's coming out next year, and it'll be much better. Nobody's going to wait. You've fallen in love with it, you want it, and you're not prepared to listen to any drawbacks about it. That's what you want. And that's what this falling in love really means. Falling in love, it's a wonderful thing. It enables people who do meet by pure dumb luck to get married, otherwise they wouldn't. It enables a human being, or it makes a human being, willing to look at the other without giving serious consideration to his faults. It makes people overlook faults. It's a wonderful thing. And if everybody was in love with everybody, maybe the world would be a very fine place. Maybe that's what the hippies were trying to teach us in the 1960s. But it doesn't work. But theoretically, that's what it is. Being in love means the ability to overlook the weaknesses and the shortcomings of the other human being. That's fine. But if you're not fully prepared for the weaknesses and the shortcomings of the other human being, you might be in for some very rude shocks. And therefore it's essential that early on in the relationship, the couple seeks the advice of somebody competent, of somebody qualified, to analyze the strengths and weaknesses of the couple, and to prepare them for the kind of problems they are going to have. Not they might have, they will have. Every marriage has problems. Every marriage has adjustment and difficulties. Every marriage goes through cycles and periods of crisis. Every marriage, no matter how successful, two different people living together are going to have problems. And it's terribly important that the couple are briefed beforehand what those problems are likely to be, exactly in what areas they are likely to fall, so that the couple can at least decide, are we strong enough to handle that kind of problem, or is that just too much for us? Because that's really what's critical in the marriage. These are the problems, can you handle them? Do you have the strength to handle them? This objective person about whom we're talking will try and examine and explain to the couple the degree to which they're complementary. Marriages where the two parties to the marriage are similar are successful in that they're peaceful. They usually don't land up in tremendous arguments, but they're terribly stagnant and terribly boring. And usually what happens, certainly in non-religious environments, is that one or both of the parties start looking for more interesting company elsewhere. You can't live with yourself terribly long. People don't like to live with images of themselves. And very often, an insecure young man particularly will seek in a wife the same qualities as he has in himself. And that's terribly dangerous. All the couple need is the ability together to make something perfect. You don't have to look in your counterpart for perfection. Firstly, because you won't find it. And secondly, because even if you find it, your marriage might be terribly unhappy. All you need to do is to look in your counterpart for those things you don't have, so that together you can make something that works. That's what's important and that's what's critical. And that's why you'll often find, you'll always find, stand around at any chuppah and just listen to some of the conversation afterwards among the people around. And you'll inevitably hear, from his side, you'll hear something like, such a fine young man, what did he see in her? What? No, she's a nice girl, nothing wrong with her, but he couldn't have married anybody. And at the same wedding, you'll hear people saying, you know, such a fantastic girl, she's a very nice young man, but she could have married a millionaire. What did she have to land up with him for? And people will never understand why A chose B and X chose Y. Because they think if there's a fantastic man who's wealthy and clever and handsome, and he marries a little girl who's poor and not so handsome, not so pretty, that she's warm whereas he's a little bit cold. And outsiders will look at that and say, a man like that, with everything to offer, could have married a princess. What did he see in her? The answer is, he saw in her just what he was missing. And the more outstanding the man is, normally the less outstanding is the girl he's going to marry, because there's less he needs from her. And the more outstanding the girl is, the less outstanding the man that she's going to marry, very often. Because all that that party needs, all that the outstanding party needs, is one or two little qualities which they're lacking, and which they happen to find in that individual. And together with that, they can make a perfect marriage. Together with that, they can make something that works. And that's what's important. That the two together should be able to make something which is round and something which is perfect. Each one on his own is not what one has to examine in order to compare the two together. This marriage consultant, or whatever you want to call him, will analyze the areas of strength and weakness of each individual. And it's really very easy, because the human personality is based in three primary areas, certainly as far as marriage is concerned. And those three primary areas are all indicated by the tefillin which we wear. There's the spiritual part, represented by the head, the element of height, stature, dimension. That's one element of personality. There's the emotional, represented by the tefillin which we put on our arm, which is next to the heart, the emotional feelings, and the practical ability. Some people are practical, they can take an idea and make it work. And some people have wonderful ideas and they can never make it work. The practical part is also one aspect of our personality. And you'll usually find that every person is strong in at least one of those three areas, and very weak in at least one of them, and so-so in one of them. That's how average people are. And one has to know about oneself and one's spouse which is which. And one has to be careful, because if you find a man who's very strong intellectually, spiritually, and very weak socially, and very weak practically, let's imagine such a guy, and he marries a girl who's very strong academically and intellectually, and very weak emotionally, and very weak practically, there's going to be chaos in that house all day. The house will be in a mess, their finances will be in a mess, supper will never be ready, and the house will never be clean, the children won't be brought up properly, there'll never be visitors in their home, and they'll never be able to socialize with their friends. What are they going to do all day and all night? Sit and discuss Shakespeare and Homer? It just doesn't work like that. That's not what a marriage is made of. Whereas a man, let's say, with a spiritual and intellectual, might land up marrying a girl who is totally non-intellectual. But whereas he's very weak socially, she's terribly strong socially. Or where he's very weak practically and he can't make anything work, she's practically very dynamic and she can make anything work. And he'll be the guy with all the wonderful ideas and she'll be the one to put it into practice. Those kind of marriages can work. And that's where this marriage counselor has to alert the couple and say, hey, watch it. You're strong in this, you're strong in this. Who's going to look after X? Who's going to look after Y? It's none of your areas of strength. You don't complement each other in this particular way. Or you do complement each other, and this is the area in which you complement each other. This is what a couple has to understand, and they can only understand it objectively fairly early on in their relationship. If a couple go too long before they consult, the consultancy is a waste of time. Because they're too committed already, they're too emotionally involved. They won't be able to understand what they're being told, and even if they are able to understand what they're being told, they won't be able to do anything about it. I've had several cases where couples come to me some just before they're getting married. Are we suited to one another? They ask you the question, you look hoping to the Ribbono Shel Olam, literally, that you'll find that they are, because, you know, if they're not, there's nothing you're going to do about it. And it's happened on a number of occasions that I found that they are unsuited to one another, and I have no doubt whatever that the marriage will not work. And I've been forced to say to them, wonderful, it will work, it's lovely. Because I know for absolute certainty at that time, if one instills a doubt into them, it will have even less chance of working. If one makes them think that things are worse than it really is, there's no way, that it really has no chance. If you tell them that it will work and it's wonderful, there's a chance. It might work, but a very small chance. And I've had a couple where I've had to say to them, yeah, it's okay, it's alright. I've tried to sound a little bit unenthusiastic in the hope that one of them will have the seichel to come back afterwards and say, look, I didn't want to say anything in front of my fiancé, but you didn't sound terribly convinced. And I would say, look, if you've already come that far, sit down, and I'll tell you why I didn't sound very convinced. But that never happens. As unconvinced as I sound, they go away, having heard just what they wanted to hear and just what they came for, and off they go into marriage, and down they come with divorce. And what can you do? And I've already made it a practice that when I have such cases, I make a note of it, I put the date on, I seal it in an envelope, not to show to the couple, chas v'sholem, just to show to my wife that she shouldn't lose confidence in me. If one's going to seek objective opinions, it must be done early. And I'm sorry to say again, this is contrary to modern practice and thought. If the relationship between boy and girl is serious, go and seek objective advice and follow that advice. If the relationship is not serious, just stop it. Cut it out. Because a relationship between boy and girl is serious. And it has ramifications. And it affects people. And you can't drop it later on without somebody getting terribly hurt, if not both getting terribly hurt. So what does one need it for? If it's not a serious relationship, it shouldn't be engaged in. I know I'm saying something which is almost impractical in the world outside. People just don't live that way. But if you want to be healthy, that's the way to live. If a relationship is not serious, cut it out. If it is serious, make sure that it's good. And if it's good, take it to its logical conclusion. I see I'm running a little bit short of time. I'm going to just finish this the dating section and possibly just give you a very small insight into next week's talk. The next big thing in the dating relationships, and this is important for discussions which will come later on during marriage as well, is the Jewish concept of boy and girl having absolutely no physical contact whatever before marriage. And I want to explain that, because that's something which is misunderstood, perhaps even more serious than misunderstood, is just not understood, and is very often not practiced. And while it's hard, very, very hard, it's terribly important. Firstly, I mentioned to you that a man's imagination is more sophisticated than a woman's. This is going to be an element which is going to be particularly important in our discussions of the sexual relationship later on. It's for that reason that a man can be sexually aroused instantly, whereas a woman normally requires a lot more time. It's the function of imagination. A man can think about a woman and become sexually aroused, never mind see a picture of one or actually see one or touch one. A woman needs a lot more than that. And as long as a woman is not physically in touch with a man, she is usually capable of remaining pretty dispassionate about the relationship. She can see it in its correct perspective. The man fluctuates. There are moments when he's completely bats and he can't see reality at all. And there are moments when he's completely normal and he can see it for what it is. But the woman can be consistently clear thinking about the relationship, provided she's not yet physically involved. Once she's physically involved, it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, for her to view the relationship dispassionately. Well, one of two things will happen as a result of her physical involvement. Either she'll be completely turned off, or she'll be completely turned on. And if she's completely turned on, she loses all perspective, she falls into love, and now you've got the two of them in love, and there's no way that that relationship can then be analyzed objectively anymore. So purely from the point of view of being able to take a look after a little while of the relationship having continued, to be able to look dispassionately and say, can this work or can't it? It's essential that there hasn't yet been a physical relationship between boy and girl. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is the difficulty of it. It's difficult in a relationship that continues for a period of time. A relationship between a boy and girl has a certain dynamicism to it. It's not something stagnant. It goes, it moves from one to another. It can't remain on the same level. A relationship between two members of the same sex can continue for a long time on the same sort of level of intensity. But a relationship between man and woman can't. It's constantly fluctuating, and if it's a successful sort of relationship, it's developing and moving towards more and more intimacy. And to be able to, within those dynamics, not to touch the girl, is terribly, terribly hard. And what it requires, again to quote Rabbi Bernard, is not willpower but won't power. And won't power is possibly the most important element in later marital life. I'll tell you straight out, a man and woman who can't restrain themselves before they're married are going to find it difficult, if not impossible, to restrain themselves after they're married. Not to restrain themselves in relationship with one another, but to restrain themselves in relationship between themselves and members of the opposite sex to whom they're not married. Where should they learn that ability for won't power? If a man is a normal man and a woman is a normal woman, particularly if the marriage is going to go through periods of stress and worse, periods of boredom, there are going to be times, fairly frequently, if not very frequently, that husband and wife are attracted to men of the other and women of the opposite sex in marriage, after marriage. And even if that leads to nothing physical, it can be terribly disturbing in the marriage, unless the couple has developed as individuals the ability of won't power, the understanding that certain things just aren't on because they're dangerous. You just don't do them. Not because of some lofty religious principles, just because you're not suicidal, that's all, just because you're normal. It is normal just to be scared of danger. And people don't understand sufficiently the dangers of behaving within a certain code. And the code of behavior of premarital relationships between male and female has basically just broken down. There is no code of behavior anymore. Anything is allowed. And that's the only time that a couple have the opportunity to develop the skills of sexual won't power. The skills of being able to control one's sexual feelings. Not to stifle them. To stifle them leads to sickness. One wants to be able to feel sexually and yet not necessarily practice everything you feel. Otherwise one just can't live. And the exercise ground for the ability to feel sexually without practicing what one feels is in premarital relationships. That's where that has to be cultivated and that's where it has to be developed. You might ask, because one psychiatrist did, he didn't ask, he told me. It's abnormal. Boy and girl, not touching one another, that's abnormal. He's right, it is abnormal. And we want to keep the relationship, the premarital relationship between boy and girl, abnormal. That's exactly what we want. It must be abnormal. Because if it isn't abnormal, it's back to the hunchbacks and to the children of one-parent families. If it isn't abnormal, then singles becomes an ideal. The singles, a new breed of people who are living a very fulfilled life, they say. They only start calling themselves singles, by the way, when they've become incapable and have failed at establishing relationships for marriage. Then they call themselves singles and they set themselves up and it becomes socially accepted and emotionally accepted, and they start convincing themselves that that's as normal a situation to be in as marriage is. A premarital relationship between boy and girl is abnormal, and it must stay abnormal, and it must be felt to be abnormal, because apart from anything else, that feeling of abnormality is a pressure towards doing something about it. Now there are only three things you can do. You can climb into bed, you can terminate, or you can get married. Climbing into bed is out if we're going to practice this principle of no physical contact. Therefore you're forced to either get married or to terminate. And that's the honest way to handle a relationship. If it's working and you love her, marry her. And if it's not working and you're not going to marry her, stop it now. And that pressure is created by not touching. If one's touching, if one's deriving a certain degree of physical gratification from the relationship before marriage, what's the hurry to get married? And therefore you find so many miserable young girls hanging after their boyfriends for year after year after year after year, while he's busy making money and doing all sorts of other things, and doesn't want to become tied down to marriage. Of course he doesn't. He wants the pleasures of a boy-girl relationship without the responsibilities of marriage. And there's nothing pressuring him into do it. So she has to start pressurizing him into doing it, and that starts spoiling the relationship altogether. It shouldn't be necessary for the girl to pressure into marriage. It shouldn't be necessary for anybody to pressure into marriage. It should be the pressures of their abnormal relationship which makes them come to a decision quickly. It's either on or it's off. But it doesn't drag on and on as something which is so dangerous. You might ask, why then no physical relationship at all? I want you to realize that in Jewish circles, a boy and girl get married without having shaken hands. In religious Jewish circles. Haven't even shaken hands with each other. You might ask, why so extreme? Okay, so you don't sleep together, but not even touch one another? The main answer to that is, where do you define the barriers between a sexual and a platonic relationship? At what point does a relationship move from being platonic to becoming sexual? So you'll say, well, if they just sit and they talk about Shakespeare, that's platonic. I agree. And you'll say, if they're in bed together, that's sexual. I'll agree with that too. And this was the discussion that I was having with a psychiatrist, in fact. He was saying boys and girls should be allowed. He agrees, not sexual contact, but physical contact. So I asked him, please, to define. At what point it becomes sexual and at what point it's physical? He said they should be allowed to kiss one another. I said, kiss one another where? He started getting very embarrassed, and that started leading to the end of the discussion. What kind of kissing? What kind of petting? So then you'll have to say, no, so you can't kiss. But you can hug. Okay, what kind of hugging? Hugging can be pretty sexual as well. Well, this kind of hugging you can, and that kind of hugging you can't, and boy and girl are going to have to go around with a little notebook of what you can do and what you can't do. It doesn't work. Besides the fact that the sexual dynamics are such that once they start, it becomes far more abnormal to stop them in the middle than it is not to stop them at all. It's abnormal enough for a boy and girl to be relating platonically. That's abnormal, as we said. But to start relating semi-sexually and not to take the relationship further is even more abnormal. So the halakha sees any physical contact between man and woman to be the borderline between a sexual and a platonic relationship. And it is so. Because a handshake between a man and a woman, they have found, is not the same as a handshake between two men, and particularly when it's an attractive woman with a man. They find that the handshake is minutely longer and a little bit more subtle. It is. It's a form of physical contact. It's a form of feeling the other person. It's a form of intimacy. It can be turned into a form of intimacy. There's no way one can allow handshakes and not allow handshakes more than 2.5 seconds. And if you're allowing 2.5 seconds, then you can allow 5 seconds. And if you're allowing a handshake of 5 seconds, why can't boy and girl hold hands? And if they can hold hands, why can't they walk with their arms around each other? And so it goes on. Where are you going to draw the line? And so halakha has chosen to draw the line, no physical contact whatever. And that's the most natural of an unnatural situation that can possibly be designed. It's as hard as anything. And it's meant to be as hard as anything. And it's that difficulty which in fact lays the rocks on which the foundations of the marriage can be built. Romance, I've already mentioned, is misleading. We're going to discuss romance and marriage later on. But romance primarily, as you're going to see, is the ability to hide what you really are and make yourself appeal more ideal than you really are. That's really what romance is. You turn off the lights so that you can't see too clearly. Then it gets romantic. Turn off the electric lights and use candlelight. And it starts getting romantic. That's very pretty and very nice romance. But at a time when boy and girl are meant to be getting to know who they really are, that's not a time really for romance. But we'll discuss that later on. And lastly, on the dating question, going steady is the most horrific tendency which there's ever been. A kid of 14 and 15 year olds, going steady. What's that mean? He's already cut out all the others. This is the one he's going out with. And then there's a whole code of behavior that you can't interfere, no? You can't take her out because she's going to study with him and he's going to study with her. And there's a whole structure that develops around it. And what happens is that relationships develop and snowball. And that kid, when he's 25, finds either that he's landing up marrying the girl he went out with steady when he was 14. Why? Just because one thing led to another. Because it just carried on and carried on and carried on. Or after many years of going steady, the relationship breaks up and there's a lot of heartbreak and there's a lot of missed out opportunity and there's a lot of lack of experience and there's a lot of experience which should be lacked, and altogether it's just... it's unwise, it's unhealthy, there's just no reason for it. Why should a 14, 15-year-old, 12-year-old, 9-year-old, I believe already, what should they be going steady for? My 4-year-old daughter's already decided who she's going marrying, and there's no going steady. That's it. I think I'm going to have to leave it here. We were going to start on the basis of a marriage. Up till now we've only spoken about the premarital preparation. Premarital sex as a concept we'll be discussing also next week together with extramarital relationships. But basically all we've covered is the preparation for marriage. The next point we're going to come to is the foundation of a marriage. And I would like you to give that a little bit of thought. It might be just as well that we've got a week to go before we discuss that, because I'm going to go around and ask some of you what you consider is the basis of a marriage. And by basis, I mean really the basis, the foundation, the thing on which the sine qua non, that without which there is no marriage. Just think about it a little bit. And work out, in fact, if you want to scribble it on a little piece of paper, if you don't want to say it out aloud, leave it on the table, that will also be fine. And I think that will come as quite a surprise to you, what the foundation of the marriage really is. But we're going to then build on that and develop from that. And I think you'll then understand how it operates. I assure you one thing, that if you follow that, after listening to the foundation of marriage, if you live that way and you follow that, there is no way, unless you were basically unsuited to one another to start with, which doesn't happen very often. As I say, that's one of the most amazing things that strengthen my belief on a day-to-day basis. How seldom I come across people who've met by chance and are unsuited. It very rarely happens. Most unhappy marriages are because they've made a mess of something that could have been very good. Many of them should never have occurred, but most of them, they've made a mess of something which should never have occurred. Provided your marriage is one which is essentially compatible, then I would assure you, with absolute guarantee, that following the principles, the understandings and the foundations which we're going to lay next week, I don't say your marriage will never go through crisis. And I don't say you won't have fights and arguments and be unhappy at times, but I promise you that your marriage will never land up in divorce, and that the periods of unhappiness will be terribly short-lived. They'll occur over issues and they'll be righted immediately. There just won't be a problem. You can be sure, if I make you such a promise, that the prescription is not going to be easy. It's not going to be a simple one. It's going to be simple, I'm sorry. It's not that it's not going to be simple. It will be simple. It's not complex, it's not complicated, but it requires a certain amount of development and self-discipline to be able to actually live in that way and function in that way. We'll discuss how much of it rests on the man's shoulders and how much of it rests on the lady's shoulders, and how they can assist one another to shoulder those responsibilities. And on that principle we'll build all the other problems and difficulties and situations that arise in marriage, and I'll show you how to use that principle to cope with those problems. So that we'll be doing next week, ladies and gentlemen. We will be starting, let's just say 8 o'clock for 10 past 8, but 10 past 8 sharp, and just as it's counterproductive to hear part of it and not to hear the other part, so coming late, just missing a first sentence or a first section can be very damaging. So please try and be here as you were this evening on time so that we can get started. Would you like to ask any questions on what we've covered so far this evening? Yeah.
Could you please tell us what you mean by the platonic relationship, and do you believe a platonic relationship exists in the premarital state? Having said that, a woman, a decent girl in the premarital state, sees her potential partner as a romantic prospect, marriageable prospect.
Yes, a platonic relationship. And you're right, I would put platonic in quotation marks, can exist only for a limited time. A couple can go out for a couple, few times together for a few months, a few weeks, a few months, whatever it is, and it can still be platonic. After that, it becomes terribly frustrating, or it needs to go into other forms of expression. That's why I stress again the importance of making up one's mind relatively quickly. Is it serious or is it unserious? If it's unserious, drop it. If it's serious, get married. How, for example?
Well, you say people come to you for guiding and counseling, etc., you can sum them up and you try to predict to them a crisis.
Oh, yes, that easy. That's absolutely easy. Obviously, you can't prophesy. You can't say, you know, it will be one day that you.
I mean, you don't look. Every marriage has different ups and downs, and some gossip that have a death, and some gossip that have the illness, and some gossip that. And, like, you know, sort of you hear people say, my God, the way he reacted there, you know, sort of. Do you really think that people react the way you.
Primarily, yes. You'll find, obviously, there'll be surprises, but they won't be surprises that can rock the marriage. And one isn't predicting reactions. You're predicting the areas of strength, the areas of weakness. You're projecting the kind of crisis which brings those areas of weakness under stress. And you're projecting how each one is capable or incapable of handling that stress. Right? So in that area, yes, you can predict pretty. You can't prophesy the event. You can't say such and such is going to happen. But you can say, were such and such to happen, a problem would exist in your marriage because you would panic and so would you. So who's going to take over? That you can say. And then you can teach the couple how to overcome that. It doesn't mean that means that there's absolutely nothing they can do. And you can say, now let's look and see what we can do about it. You are more likely to be able to cope with it. But you need to learn to do A, B, C, D. And you can give him exercises to learn to do it and to become proficient in certain areas. And you can teach her how to help him to cope with such a case and so on.
The thing is, if you try to teach people how to work with their marriages, most people don't try.
No, actually you're wrong. I'm trying to teach people how to work on themselves. Because if one works on oneself... Right, if you work on yourself, you're okay. If you understand yourself and you're working on yourself, you can cope with any crisis that there is. It's people who are just not getting to grips with themselves, aren't facing themselves, and aren't raising and improving themselves, that find that they're constantly hitting areas that they can't cope with. I always say rather anybody than nobody, because anybody is more qualified than the couple is. Right, they can stop an African at the bus stop, and that African at the bus stop will be able to give a more learned and valuable opinion on the worthwhileness of the marriage than the couple themselves. So anybody rather than themselves. Then there's the question of professional marriage guidance people and counselors and so on. I, not just because of a personal bias, but because of a belief, and I'll explain the belief to you, believe that a competent rabbi... I don't say there are that many of them around, is the preference. And the reason that I say that is because a rabbi's training is in one area is extremely different to the training of any other professional. Every other professional is disciplined strictly to follow the discipline of his particular training. For example, a lawyer, let's say, is sitting in a law class and the professor will put a certain argument to him. And the student will say, yeah, I like that argument. And the professor will say, what do you like about that argument, young man? He'll say, it's so beautiful. It's so lovely and it expresses all sorts of lovely ideas. So that's not how a lawyer talks. I want facts. I want you to show me why logically that's a good argument. So he's hammered into thinking in an analytical, legal way of thinking. A psychiatrist is taught to think clinically, to think scientifically. A psychologist, less so than other professions, because he's dealing with human things more than anything else. But even there, the profession has certain limited disciplines and ways of thinking. Human beings are just so complex that the moment you look at them from any limited point of view, you're bound to have a limited judgment of them. A rabbi's training is primarily in Gemara learning. And Gemara learning, as those of you who have experienced it will know, is the broadest form of education that there can possibly be. Because if you analyze your Gemara only legally, you won't understand it. And if you examine your Gemara only artistically, you won't understand it either. And if you examine it scientifically, you also won't understand it. You need to look at a piece of Gemara from every angle of personality and of discipline. One has to see a legal side to it and a scientific side to it and a literary side to it and an artistic side to it and a psychological side to it. Everything. You have to apply your total personality to finally understanding what lies at the bottom of that piece of Gemara. And there's no finer training for the handling of human beings than the learning of Gemara. That's why I say a rabbi who's learned Gemara and has a natural intuition with people is, as far as I'm concerned, the most competent person to handle this at the outset. He might very well and very often does say, look, there's a particular problem here which I either cannot handle or don't have the time to handle. I suggest you see a marriage counselor for that, or I suggest you see a psychologist. This is the person I recommend, or a lawyer or a doctor or whatever it is. But the same as medicine must have a GP or should have a GP. The guy who knows the person, the guy who has the most rounded feeling of what's really going on, and he will refer to specialization where necessary, so in human problems, the GP should be the rabbi. He'll send to specialists when it needs to go to a specialist, but nobody will understand a human problem better than a rabbi will.